Today's program was brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45 or so. Joined, as usual, with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
And we got Rebecca live tweeting over there in the booth with Jack Inslee, Jackie Molecules, our intrepid engineer. How you doing, guys?
Sorry, we're good. I can't believe we're so on time today. That's miraculous.
Well, in order to get me here on time, you have to get me flying in from the passport office in Stanford, Connecticut, which we can talk about in a bit. But special guest in the studio today, Harold McGee. That's right. That's right. He's here. I didn't give you any advance notice because I only want diehard fans to be able to call in to 718-497-2128. That is, and I will say it at a reasonable pace this time, 718-497-2128. Is that even right? Because I can't do it slowly.
497-2128.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so call in your questions to Harold McGee. I mean, probably you should keep them to a kind of a cooking-related kind of a theme, but, you know, it's up to you. You know, he's pretty open. Harold is in town because he is going to do a talk at the Museum of Food and Drink Lab on 62 Bayard Street this week on Thursday, right?
Thursday.
What time is it?
6:30.
And I believe you can still – I don't know. It's probably sold out, but, you know, don't listen to me. Go on the MOFAD website and look up – I think under the program you can see – and what are you going to be talking about?
Stuff. Peter Kim and I, Peter, the director of the museum, and I are going to just kind of chat about flavor and then take questions from the audience.
So flavor, you're for it or against it?
Mostly for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. There is an anti-flavor thing going on now. It's kind of like the – it goes part of the theme of sugar, salt, fat, whatever order that is, plus, you know, the Dorito effect, basically chiding corporations on their pernicious inclusion of those addicting flavors into food. So you're not part of the anti-flavor.
No, band. It kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if I was a corporation, which I guess, Stas, we are kind of a corporation. We're an LLC. We're not a mega corporation, though. Like, we're not hated yet for our...
You are an LLC.
Well, me personally. I have a personal...
You have an LLC.
But Booker and Dax is an LLC.
Booker
and Dax is an LLC.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're not, like, a mega corporation. People can't hate us for that yet. We don't have, like, corporate hegemony yet. We haven't reached kind of that Monsanto level yet, right? We're not, you know, mucking about with whole cultures yet. Where was I going with this? So yeah, so you, I mean, obviously, corporations want to make stuff taste better for people. I mean, it seems obvious.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And you would expect them to do that. So.
Yeah. All right. I have a question in actually that I know you have thoughts on from last week. Unless you have something super pressing, I have last week's questions.
No, I have. Twitter questions for you.
All right, let me tackle this one. This is in from actually a family member of mine, Brady Huggett. Just wanted us to comment on the whole Aquabest. Aquabest, is that the name of the corporation? The salmon, the genetically engineered salmon that just got approved, and the people who vow to squash it. Do you want to talk about that, or do you want to leave it untalked about? Do you not want to dip your toes into the water of genetically engineered salmon? Perhaps I should tell people what it is first. It's a salmon that's been, I believe, they've basically taken and made it, I don't know whether it's an addition or a deletion of a gene. I haven't researched it enough.
An addition from a fish called the pout.
The pout?
Yes.
Wow, that's a nice thing. Does it look pouty, the fish? Is it named for its look?
I've never beholden a pout.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, it's like kind of the poorly named. It's pronounced crappie, but written crappy. Which, why would you want to name a fish crappie? But anyway, so it grows faster, has better feed conversion ratio than ordinary salmon, right? Yep. And so, what are your thoughts on it?
My thought is, I've been following this now for, 15 years or something like that, that they first put the gene in the fish and began to talk about this. I'm amazed that they're still able to have a proposal in front of the FDA. And I'm a kind of fascinated bystander. I don't have strong feelings one way or the other. I think it's important to make sure that fish that have been engineered don't get out into the world at large. I can't see how a fish engineered in this particular way is going to be a problem for human consumers. So I want to see what happens.
Yeah, there's been a lot of bad information out there on it. One of the interesting things is that the fear is that you're going to have an American crayfish. One of the fears is that you're going to have like an American crayfish kind of a situation where these salmon get out there, start interbreeding with the regular salmon, and then all hell breaks loose, and you get these fast growing salmon that are clogging up. I guess this is one of the we lose. Yeah, right. I mean, that's the fear. So for those of you that don't know, what happened is these fish are sterile. They're only releasing one sex of fish, female, and those females are, I believe it's female, and those females are sterile. So they're not able to have baby fish, right? So that's supposed to get around the thing. Stas, when was the last time you saw Jurassic Park? It's been a long time.
Okay.
Those were also supposed to be sterile, right? Now remember, this is a movie written from a book by a guy who's now dead. But does anyone remember how it is that the Jurassic Park, anyone? Harold, do you remember that? Rebecca, Jack, you remember how that worked?
It's been too long.
Maybe someone can tweet in how, in a fictional account, the sterility of the Tyrannosaurus Rex, whatever it was, Velociraptor, I believe it was in this case, how that was, how that life will find a way, as Jeff Goldblum said in one of his more irritating roles. Anyways, the point is that they're engineered to be sterile, and some of the people who are against this fish basically are – they point out a study that was done that proves that this fish can actually interbreed with regular fish, and so the fish was supplied to them by the company that makes them. Mm-hmm. However, they supplied them with genetically engineered yet – non-sterile fish specifically for this study. So the study was to show that if you didn't have a sterilized fish, could it interbreed with the regular wild population of brown trout and salmon? Because they're worried about the brown trout, because remember, these are being raised inland. So the question is can this salmon hybridize with inland like lake and river brown trout, should it like make it out into the thing? And they found out that yes, it can, if they were not sterilized, and albeit only poorly even in that case. And yet this is touted as being that it's possible for the ones that they're going to raise to go out into the wild. Have you read this stuff?
Yes. Yeah, so it seems pretty ironclad, but I'm glad that there are people out there, pushing, making sure for the rest of us.
Yeah. So, but what I don't like is just like the falseness of
Leaving out important details.
Yes, like the fish that they tested that could interbreed only poorly actually weren't the fish that people are actually raising. They were
exactly.
Whatever. It's just people like it's very hard to get any good information on either side. All right, so you want to do some Twitter questions?
Sure.
What are we gonna do? All right.
So Nut Milk King wants to know, Dave, any thoughts or info on dry aging turkey? Best duck I had was at EMP, and it was aged for a week. That's a different meat, obviously. Curious.
I like how Nut Milk King is bi curious. That's great. I've never aged a turkey, which by the way, I messed up the Thanksgiving turkey a little bit. It was still delicious, but I did mess it up a little bit. We could talk about that later. They were heritage breed turkeys, and they were. I thought they were delicious. Did you try it, or were you too busy? It was good, right? They're good. Mm-hmm. Did you try the confit and the breast?
No.
You didn't try the confit?
No.
Confit was good. Anyway, I confit the legs out this year.
Uh-huh.
The problem is that it was very hard to arrange them into a bird, and I didn't have a bag big enough to do the breasts. And so, like, I tried to do a traditional cooking technique on the breasts. Next year, if I do a similar thing, which I probably will, I'm going to have to bust out the meat glue. I just didn't have the meat glue with me where I was. I didn't adequately plan. I thought that just giving it time would, but I didn't adequately plan my equipment regimen to do it. But anyway, my bad. Still delicious.
Finished in the tandoor.
Oh, yeah, I did one in the tandoor, and I didn't end up deep frying the other one. I ended up doing the other one in the oven. But, yeah, the tandoor – okay, here's the issue with the tandoor, right? So I had the bird around the stuffing plug, right, with uncooked breast, but the stuffing plug was hot. So I was hoping that the stuffing plug would cook the breast meat from the inside out while I was going into the tandoor. Now, the tandoor goes back to, you know, what we've said many times is that you want very high instantaneous heat input but low average heat input. So the way you do a tandoor is in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. You know, but the cool thing is when it's in, it's getting hit from all sides at once.
Yeah.
So I bought a pair of cheap vice grips and vice gripped on the bottom of this, put the turkey on, wrapped it with a stuffing plug, tied it real tight so it looked kind of like a turkey football. It didn't have any bones in it except for the bones and the confit because they were already cooked out though, right? But the breast area had no bones. Then a ball of tinfoil to separate it from the next thing, and then a layer of tinfoil in the vice grip, the tinfoil to stop the intense heat from the live coals from burning the bottom side of the bird. Uh-huh. But there was just so much grease that, and the turkey was so large relative to the size of the tandoor, and I so stoked the tandoor with coals that it was like a freaking disco inferno inside of the tandoor. It was like, and then when I left it in there, so usually like when you're cooking in a tandoor and you start getting flames off of like whatever grease is in the thing, you can close the bottom like air vent a little bit, you damp that up a little bit, and then you put the lid back on the top except for the little place where the skewers are coming out, and that deprives the enough oxygen usually that you don't get enough, like a large kind of a flames, but not when you have this much grease pouring off of the turkey. So then I pulled the turkey, you know, I had it actually two skewers through it, right? So I could do a double grip. So the trick to any having a tandoor is having a place you can put the skewers to rest in between your firings of the tandoor that's not like the ground or something else. So I have a spiral staircase next to the tandoor, so I was like putting them on the spiral staircase. But I went to go readjust, and it poured hot grease like all over my finger. You can still see the wrinkle marks in my finger from what used to kind of be a normal finger. So that was unpleasant. But it tasted good. It was good. I would do it again, albeit a little bit differently. I would dry the bird more beforehand and maybe cook it all low temp with the bones in, which is anathema normally. I don't know. I got to figure it out. But I would definitely tandoor it again because I like the flavor of the tandoor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have ambitions to start tandooring.
You need to own a tandoor.
Yeah.
First of all, you have a house and a backyard.
Yes.
So, tandoor. you know, I'm sure there's some place in San Francisco that sells them, but the place in New Jersey ships them. The problem is that the shipping charge is a little bit high, I think. Uh-huh. Hey, I got to get a tandoor. Tandoor is the best. I love the tandoor. Hashtag vertical grilling. It's the best. You know, the only question when I do steaks, I put the, you know, those like crappy fish grills that you can buy or veggie grills that you can buy. I have a bunch of those, and those usually have a place where you can where it folds down and you put a clip over it to hold it down.
Yeah.
And so that's a perfect place to shove a skewer through. So typically what I'll do is I'll throw like a steak or anything like that, you know, pieces that can't be skewered easily, and put them in the basket and then put them in the tandoor, suspend it over another skewer and close it. And so that's the way you do things that aren't normally tandoored.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's how you vertically grill things like that. Yeah. anywho. But that doesn't answer the question. Dry aging turkey, what do you think?
You got to play with it. I mean, I've never done it before, so I would do it once, maybe plan on doing it for longer than is probably ideal and see if that's the case. Maybe check it out as it's going. But I'd hang on to it for, I don't know, 10 days, something like that.
Would you salt it ahead of time to stop any sort of anything that's kind of growing on the outside?
I don't know. Maybe wipe it with vinegar every once in a while.
Hmm. Try to kill it or something.
Yeah, yeah. Just keep it clean.
What about choosing a bird that whose meat is inherently darker? Is that going to be good, like a heritage style bird, as opposed to a butterball?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, and of course, butterballs have other stuff floating around in there.
Diacetyl and oil.
Yes.
Do they actually put butter in a butterball?
No idea. No idea. Haven't looked at the ingredient list recently.
You know who I bet you has tried to dry age a turkey? Johnny Hunter. I bet you Johnny Hunter's tried to dry age a turkey. Maybe he'll write in. All right. Anyway. All right. What else? What else we got? What else we got, Steph?
Actually, I got a caller.
Oh, caller, caller! You're on the air.
Hi, Dave. This is Jeffrey from Costa Mesa.
How you doing?
Better now that I have the sweet Jackie Molecules ringtone on my phone.
Ah, nice. That means you're a member.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We'll play the ringtone maybe at the break.
Except for when people call and I answer at the right time, I instinctively say, Jackie Molecules, and then they hang up because they think they have the wrong number.
Well, you know what though? Do you want to talk to those people? Do you want to talk to people?
Not necessarily, no.
Yeah, no.
So it works out.
Yeah, it's perfect.
I called in about blanching French fries for a shorter amount of time.
Okay.
A couple weeks ago.
Right, and what happened?
Just following up with that. It seemed as though... So I tried a few different times for the blanch and basically pushed to the lowest amount of time, or sorry, the most amount of time I could get without them starting to all shatter.
Right. So the theory here was, by the way, the call was about, you know, when you blanch it as long as, you know, I usually do to get the best textural effect in the French fry, the potatoes are so loose that they're really beat up by the end. And so then, like, kind of getting around this. Go ahead.
Right. So about 9 or 10 minutes was sort of the furthest I could go without, you know, a large amount of them shattering. And so in about 10 minutes, it seemed like the starch was pretty well gelatinized, had a decent salt penetration. So then I tried a few different oven temperatures and had kind of some interesting results. So at 300, it was pretty consistently got, like, hollow fry.
Right.
Up at 350, they were a little more sort of dense, but the people that were kind of blind trying them, they liked the 350. And then 400 was my favorite. No hollow fry, pretty soft, kind of good, pillowy potato texture. So 400 seemed to be the way to go for, you know, another 10 minutes before frying.
Was the 400 less time than the 3 and change that had the hollow fry?
No, I did them all for 10 minutes just to see what would happen with that. So that was curious.
That's strange, right? So, yeah. I mean, Harold, do you remember, like, the problem of French fries obviously is one of breaking the starch first to get the texture that you want, but also moisture control both throughout the fry and at the crisp surface, right? Mm-hmm. And usually hollow fry is the result of over drying. At least in my theory, it's of over drying, and so you lose kind of the substance that's on the inside of the fry, and it basically just has this crisp outside. But it's kind of odd, right, that you would have hollow fry at 3 and change or 300.
Right. 300
for 10 minutes and then not hollow fry. You know what? I bet you you're case hardening it.
Is it like a dehydration effect that's happening at the lower temperature?
Well, I think I think the lower temperature is probably more effectively dehydrating the entire fry.
Yeah.
And that you must be getting some sort of case hardening effect at the higher temperature, and you're probably also evacuating moisture at such a high rate at the surface that maybe you're – no, I'm not saying it's like searing where there's a fake sealing of the crust. But I'm saying you're probably doing something to dense up the surface of the fry.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be, right? It's the only explanation I can think of, right?
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, so am I dumb or just masochistic to, after I go through all these steps to make a French fry, adding an additional step, and that feels normal?
No, that's good. That's good. I mean, first of all, like, there isn't normally a drying step anyway, so you're just having that drying step take place in an oven, right?
Right.
And by the way, like, this is how everything in the world happens, through observation. Like, if you had asked us, I presume, Harold, I mean, if you had asked us what would happen when you jack the temperature, I would have said more hollow fry.
More hollow, right.
That's what I would have said, you know, not knowing. Right. But this is why it's very hard to answer questions from a theoretical basis, and you need to actually do the tests and pay attention to what goes on, you know?
Yeah.
This is why you should always beware of people who tell you that they have the answer to something unless they actually run the specific test that they're telling you about. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. So what about I was wondering then about getting better salt penetration with that limited blanch time.
Mm-hmm.
Would it affect the way that the Pectinex is able to affect, you know, the starch and everything, if I added salt to that bath? So I do that, you know, the hour-long Pectinex Ultra.
Well, so. I'm very I don't know how much the salt is going to affect the enzyme, but just on a theoretical basis, I am suspicious that in the absence of the high blanching temperature that you're going to get too much more penetration than you will just by upping the salt content in your blanch water. What do you think, Harold?
Yeah, I'm not actually clear on this part of the system.
Oh, so the real, like, hardcore French fry technique, right, is so you know how the modernist folk they do the ultrasonic bath to mess with the surface of the fry.
Uh-huh.
So, like, the one that, you know, we do is soak it in a Pectinex bath, which kind of disrupts the surface of the fry.
Uh-huh.
But and that's our first step prior to. So you know how, like, you rinse the starch off normally and mm-hmm. in water, you soak it. Some people soak it for a long time to extract excess soluble sugar from the potato. Then you do your water blanch step with salt to put salt in and do the pre-cook on the starch. Then the question of drying, which we just addressed. Then fry one. Then sometimes freeze, depending on what you want. And then fry two, right?
Yeah.
This is how you make a French fry.
Yeah.
This is how God would make a French fry. anyway, so the point is that on the enzyme soak thing, I don't think – for instance, just soaking a potato in salty water, I don't think is going to get – appreciably more penetration than just upping the salt content of the hot blanch water, because it's just so much faster, the hot blanch water.
Yeah.
I would just jack the salt level in the blanch.
Yeah. I'll give that a try.
Yeah.
And thanks to your recommendation, I'll now be finishing fries in an outdoor Cajun fryer.
Oh, yeah. Let us know how the Cajun fryer works.
And I got to give a kind of props to them. I called their owner the night before Thanksgiving. We had that thing delivered. We're setting it up, and it wasn't lighting. So I called them. We're in California. I called them like 7:15 their time. They just give like the home phone number for emergencies.
Wow.
So I called the owner, and he answered the phone, kind of talked me through banging the regulator on the tank, and got it working. So.
And I'd recommend, did it work well?
The
it worked well.
Fryer to anybody.
It worked well.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Right.
Good to know.
Well, thanks for that.
And you can buy the Cajun fryer at Bass Pro Shops. Although we're not affiliated yet with
Bass
Pro
come
Shops,
on now.
So, you know. Anyway. All right.
I got a bunch of questions in the chat for Harold if we want to start getting some of those.
All right. Shoot.
All right. We'll go with the most recent one first. How about this? Interested in hearing Harold's thoughts on the bean liquid egg substitute aquafaba.
Right. I've gotten more emails about that than anything I can remember, at least in recent years. So it's the liquid from a can of chickpeas whips up into a nice meringue. And as far as I can tell, of course, there's protein in there and starch, but apparently there's also a fair amount of saponins, which are molecules that are good at foaming. so that you've got stuff in there that wants to foam, and then stuff in there that's going to stabilize a foam, like the dissolved starch and protein. And the combination is this unexpected boon to vegan meringue makers.
So for those of you that don't are not aware of the kind of genesis of On Food and Cooking, Harold's first book, it was as a result of him studying the fart-inducing principle of beans. Right? And so is part of that the saponins as well, or is that simply the polysaccharides that you don't digest that the bacteria?
I don't think saponins are flatulogenic. No.
Well, that is a fantastic word.
That's a very good word.
That's a fantastic word. You like that word, Stas? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even Nastasia likes that word, and that's so unusual for her to like a word. She has, like, her happy Stas face on. It's unusual in a situation like this.
So I got some more in here we should get to. All right. Let's see. Our old friend Elliot. Hey, Harold, can you talk about fermentation of herb stems in milk? Herb stems, sorry.
Herb stems in milk.
Which herb?
I don't know. He's here. He can probably answer that
quickly. I know for a fact that, Harold, you've done work with amaranth stalks, but not in milk.
No. And there the aim is to make something as stinky as possible. I think that's not likely with this one. In milk you would get a lactic fermentation. Maybe the herb stems would be carrying naturally occurring lactobacilli, lactococci into the milk, and so they might help seed it. But I don't see what the connection would be between the herb stems and the milk.
I bet you that's a word Stas hates, lactococci. Yeah. But
one for one.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on the herb. Like, cardoons will break it, right? I mean, it's like it depends on...
Yeah, that's true. But I'm thinking herbs that I would think of would be more like, you know, parsley and things like that, and I'm not sure that they have any active principles. And cardoons, yeah, they've got a lot of tannin. I think that's what causes the coagulation when you're doing them a blanc.
Well, what's the rennetting thing in the rest of the thistle family all about?
That's in the flower, cardoon flower. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a separate, that's an actual enzyme.
That's right, yeah. That is almost identical to the enzyme in calf stomach, crazily enough.
P.S., all you people that hate genetically modified food, all your cheese is made with genetically modified rennet.
Caller,
you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. Had a question for you on the turkey in a bag from Thanksgiving. We had the debate and didn't know if it was... It started out, we thought it was a cheap gimmick, you know, where you cook the turkey in a bag.
You're talking about the oven bags?
But I kind of like large, I don't know, it's a baking bag. Holds all the moisture in.
Gotcha.
And then we concluded that it might be like a poor man's combi, and we can't decide what the science is going on inside the bag.
Okay, well, every 20 years or so, 20 to 30 years, as far as I can tell, bag cooking makes a big a renaissance. So paper bag cooking was big when I was a kid. It's not paper anymore, but bag cooking. And by the way, bag cooking, not like sous vide bag. We're talking bag like a large en papillote style bag is big now. I have a book from the early 1900s from Alexis Sawyer's like son or grandson on paper bag cookery back when paper first started to be regular paper first started to be non-toxic so that it could be used in kind of cooking. So this is something that comes back again and again, and usually things that come back again and again have some merit, I would say, although I don't necessarily know what that merit is. Have you thought about this at all, Harold?
Well, I'd actually look at it the other way around. If things kind of come and go, they go because they don't work so well, right? And then come back because people forget.
Specifically the question here is like, is it like a poor man's combi, right? Like, are you keeping the steam in? I don't know. Like, I used to, the paper bag chicken that I used to make when I was a kid, my memory of it is that it was good. It doesn't steam the bird in the sense that it the skin gets crispy. So it's not...
Well, this is a different kind of bag, I guess, we're talking about. This one's much more plasticky, and well, I have a, my mother-in-law loves doing it, and I have to keep convincing her, if you're going to do the bag, at least open it up so the skin can get crispy, because while the turkey's cooked, her skin's never...
Yeah, I think...
We're missing the best part.
I think this is the... I think it's nylon that these baking bags are made out, or something like that, you know, some polymer that can take high temperatures. And I think the thing about them is that you are essentially, because they are impermeable, unlike paper, right. You are trapping the steam and you're not getting evaporative cooling, so you're essentially steaming or boiling the bird. You do get, I think, some radiant heat through the bag so that it can kind of crisp up in spots. But because the humidity is so high in there, it's limited.
So they're not you don't poke holes in this bag.
No, you I think you are supposed to leave the end that you tie off not tied off tightly.
Right.
So you do lose some, but I think the effective surface area of whatever opening there is so small that it's negligible.
So you don't have the ability to lose enough moisture to have a what they call high relative humidity, whatever that means at elevated temperature, but elevated to the point where it's browning efficiently.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be unfortunate.
Yes.
I know you can cook a paper bag chicken and have the chicken be crispy. But you have to use the old school big paper bags, and you know you have to put plenty of butter on the skin of the chicken.
Yeah.
But again, maybe I was just wrong. Maybe you're asking me to remember what stuff tasted like when I was like 8 and 9 years old. That was like, you know, or 10. That's when I was, you know, doing my paper bag work. And it is true that using the modern silicone sealed parchment paper on papillote style, you get basically exclusively steamed results.
Mm-hmm.
Out of things like fish. Do you like en papillote cooking in general, or do you hate it?
I like it if I want to cook fish and not have my house smell fishy. So I'll cook it en papillote and then let it cool down so that, you know, it doesn't, the moment I open it up, it doesn't just fill the space with fish smell.
Oh, well, what about the idea of that, like, you know how, like, when you make an excellent, like, dashi, it's all about that moment, that aromatic reveal?
Yeah.
Don't you like that aspect of the en papillote?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's nice in somebody else's house or restaurant.
What do you think, Stas, about your house filled with fish smell?
No.
No?
No.
You know what I detest? The oil, overheated fish oil is the worst.
Mm-hmm.
That is the worst. That stuff never, except for when I'm doing sardines in a pan, I don't mind it. Because there's just something so – I mean, I don't like it the next day. But there's just something so marvelous about sardines cooked on a high heat.
Yes, yes.
You know?
Yeah. And I have my favorite places to go to get that in San Francisco.
Really? What is it?
Well, actually, it used to be in Encanto, which is now closed. But Coxcomb does sardines also. So Chris Cosentino's place.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm sure he can cook a sardine up.
Oh, yeah.
Stas, what are your thoughts on sardines?
Like them.
Like them a lot. Do you also like canned sardines?
Okay.
Okay, James Beard, right, among many, he had many faults. One was preferred electric, now I'm not talking induction, I'm talking crappy resistance electric range tops to gas. True story. Also thought that canned sardines were far superior to fresh sardines. Now, he's from the Pacific Northwest, right? So presumably he could get good sardines. So this is just craziness. Like, I think that they're not the same product. I don't think they should be compared. I don't think that they're similar. Not only do I think that they're, like different, I think they are dissimilar products.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I agree. I love canned sardines, and I love aged canned sardines. You know, you can get vintage aged.
Yeah, we've tasted them together,
that's right. Yeah. But you're right. You couldn't do that to a sardine, and they're just they offer different experiences.
Do you pick out the weird calcium bonelets from the canned sardines, or you
no,
eat them?
That's part of the deal.
Yeah. You and Booker both. What about you, Stas? Do you like that? Do you mind that? You know what I'm talking about? The backbone? Do you pull the backbone out of your canned sardines? Or are you the fancy folk that buy the skinless boneless?
I don't know. Skinless boneless, I guess.
Skinless boneless. I have to admit, I like skinless bones. I don't, texturally, because it's gritty. Uh-huh. It's not that it's crunchy, it's gritty. Because the bones have dissolved and all you have are these little kind of calcium bitlets left. Yeah. Not a fan of the calcium bitlet.
Uh-huh.
What about in the engineering booth? Rebecca, Jack, you going to weigh in on the calcium bitlets?
I got nothing for you there.
Nothing? You guys don't eat sardines?
Don't like sardines.
What?
No, I like sardines.
Wait, Rebecca, you don't like any form of sardine?
I don't think so. Maybe on a Caesar salad?
What? No.
I don't even like that much.
That is an anchovy.
Ah, I knew it. As soon as I said I knew you were going
to... That is an anchovy.
I apologize.
All right,
no.
So you're saying you don't like anchovies either.
Not particularly. I don't like little slimy fish.
Whoa.
She also doesn't like bubbly water.
Oh, my God.
Don't say that on the air.
Oh, jeez. Spoiled. But here's my point. A good anchovy is not slimy. Like, look. Here's what you don't want to, like, start your life in anchovies. Go buy a can of salted anchovies. Just straight salted anchovies.
Maybe you should make me some.
Stas, you like anchovy pasta, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you make it with the crappy canned stuff, or do you make it with the salted stuff? I make it with the salted stuff. You make it with the salted stuff, Harold?
Yeah.
I do, too. Here's another thing. The white anchovy the cured white anchovy, they are not the same thing. I do not like people saying that they are better than salted and then oiled anchovies. I think that they are different. And frankly, I'm a weirdo, but I could eat more salted anchovy than I could the cured. I don't know. Everyone loves them. I love them. They're good, but they're not the same product. They shouldn't be compared.
Yeah.
You agree?
Yeah. 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 No. This wonderful bounty, this cornucopia of different fish products.
Yeah.
They're all different.
Yeah. 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 Hey, people, is cod the same as salted cod? No. No, they're different. They're different products.
Got another question here in the chat room.
What do you got?
What are some of Dave, this is an easy one. What are some of Dave and Harold's holiday gift suggestions for an aspiring home cook? Already have a circulator and a good set of pots and pans.
Mm.
Long-time listener, first-time question.
Well, if you have money, you should wait for us to release the centrifuge. Boom!
Exactly.
Boom!
That was the setup.
All right. That's a nice setup. But what do you think, Harold? What do you like to give people, probably food-related?
A hypodermic needle-style thermometer.
Mm.
You can stick it into any size piece of meat or fish. You don't see a hole afterwards, and you can check like 30 different places in 30 seconds.
Right. And by the way, there are things on the market that are referred to as hypodermic that really are not.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it looks like it could put a hole in you without leaving too much of a mark, then that's what
you're looking for.
That's what you're looking for. However,
yeah.
I don't know whether I said this on the air or whether I've just said it to other people. Don't ever use that thing as a candy thermometer. Don't ever put that into deep fry oil because you will ruin it.
Yeah.
Very quickly. And they're not cheap. They're cheaper than they used to be. They're under $100 now, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like between 50 and 75 these days.
Yeah. But then you're still into it for a thermocouple thermometer. So you need to buy the probe and the thermometer. Or do they come in
the
package
now? You can get the package, but the probe is a plug-in, so you can buy replacements. Right. You can buy one on a wire and all kinds of nice things.
You will be tempted to use it as a candy thermometer. Don't. You will be tempted to test the temperature of your deep fry oil with it. Do not. Do not. Do not do that. I've ruined more than two. All right. That's good.
I have to shout out Renee Kasberg, who just made a donation. Looks Woo! Like all the way from Norway.
Norway!
So that's awesome.
I like that. Never been in Norway.
No, me neither.
Me neither. I'd love to.
No? Yeah. Been to Sweden. Never been to Norway. Never really been to Denmark.
Yeah. I've just been to Copenhagen.
Yeah. And you're like, that doesn't count. Crap on them. It's like the Jersey of Denmark. I'm just kidding. It's not. All right.
Good. Holiday question here, unless you have one.
Go.
Chat room is live here.
Yeah.
So, Harold and Dave, can you advise on the minimum ABV for aged eggnog? The Dr. Lancefield recipe seems to work out at about 15% ABV, but other recipes on the web aim for 20.
Well, if 15 is good, 20 is going to be fine. I mean, how low do you want it to go? That's the question, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that one's the one from the Rockefeller, right? The one that is being quoted is the one from the Rockefeller University. That's the Lancefield one, the one that they actually did a challenge test on. So I think that's the one that they're referring to. So that this doctor at the Rockefeller, she had this eggnog recipe, and they made it every year. And someone was like, hey, man, just save my mom. And they're like, well, this is what we do for a living. And so they did a challenge test, and they looked at the kill rate and how long it took to kill off the stuff with a certain level of initial bacterial load and a certain ABV and et cetera, et cetera. And it was, you know, on the order, if it was aged for, I forget what it was, like a couple of weeks, that it, you know, becomes safer and safer. Mm-hmm. Same like mayonnaise, same like using eggs in any cocktail where you're not actually killing the salmonella quickly.
Yeah.
So the answer is that there are two separate problems. One, what is the ABV required to maintain bacterial static the bacteriostatic nature of it, right? And two, like at a given ABV, how long does it take to become safe if it were contaminated at the get-go? And those seem to me to be two different things, right? So you could say, I know that within 3 weeks or 2 weeks, whatever it is, 15% ABV is safe. However, once decontaminated, perhaps it could be diluted down to 10 or 12 or less. I mean, think beer doesn't get nasty contaminants in it. It can get ruined. You can have yeast growth. You can have all these other things, but you're not getting anything that'll kill you in it, and that is down – that's much lower. I think even if you were to crack an egg into beer as long as it was pre-pasteurized, I don't think salmonella can grow at those alcohol percentages. What do you think, Harold?
I'd want to check.
I would check. I mean, this is all just theorizing in my head, but
yeah. Well, I don't know. Beer is different because beer is pretty lean by comparison.
And it's carbonated, though.
Yeah, that too. Both of which I think work against bacteria in a way that an eggnog mix does not. Right?
That's correct.
All that protein, all that fat, lower acidity. So I think you'd want to. What I don't understand though is why go lower
than 15?
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, especially because the other recipes cited are higher.
Yeah,
going higher is definitely going to make you safer.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's just always wanting to play with the border, right? See how far you can go. But I'm not. I just don't think that. Alcohol contributes to the flavor of the drink, and I think if you go too low, it's going to be like a milkshake, right?
Yes. Now you've put Kelly's song into my head. I got the milkshake song going through my head, which is it's not unfortunate. I guess it's fine. Stas, do you like that song?
No.
You've always hated it, or just now that I'm mentioning it?
I've always hated it.
No, me too. Right.
Wow. Wow. All right. So, Stas, why don't you give us a Twitter question so they don't feel left out here?
Someone wants to know if they should crank the TS-8000 all the way up while they're using the steers ball.
Yes.
Okay.
The answer is always yes.
I think they were scared.
Oh, don't be scared. There are things in life to be scared of. That is not one of them.
Brunt Grupton wants to know, ever use birch syrup in a drink? So far, all I've made is a maple leaf variation, and it tastes flat.
Excuse me, what was that name?
Brunt Gumption.
Oh, that's funny.
Awesome. So the only birch syrup I've ever had was flawed. And I still not yet received a good birch syrup. It was acidic. And I'm assuming that it wasn't the nature of the birch syrup itself to be overly acidic. It tasted acidic and like matterized. Something had happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
I said this before on the air, and someone pointed out a good birch syrup supplier. I just haven't had it yet. I would love to have it, but presumably it's going to taste different from maple syrup. I don't know. I have not had any experience with a birch syrup that I can say, yeah, I know how birch syrup's supposed to act. But I'm interested in it, very interested in it. I'm interested in all sorts of tree exudates and saps and their various you know, things. Like, so someone called in before, remember, and they were going to try to get liquid M-Bar Styracophylla resin, like sweet gum resin. I wonder whether that happened. I want to taste that, too. Plenty of stuff I want to taste like that. But you had any, Harold, you had any experience with birch syrup?
I had some, just a taste, years and years ago, and I just remember it tasting sweet and not maple-y, more, kind of more in the direction of just sort of brown syrup, caramel flavors.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm going to give a shout-out to Crosby Molasses. Crosby Molasses, in terms of brown sugar, people think, when they think of molasses, they think of like that, I believe the brand is actually Grandma's, you know, sulfur black strap molasses. Mm-hmm. And you would never dream of putting that, for instance, on pancakes. Never. You would never think to do it.
Yeah.
Because you're like, why the hell would I want that monstrosity on my pancake, right? But there is much more in the world of molasses than that. And so for those of you that are fortunate enough to be in New England area, go get you some Crosby's molasses. That stuff is delicious. Delicious. Anyway.
Okay. Dean Musson wants to know, any chance of an episode on pots and pans, Dave? So much bullshit advice out there on the consumer end of the market.
What specific kind of BS are we referring to? That's the question. So, like, yeah, we could do one. I mean, you know, Harold and I, we used to teach, and, you know, Harold also independently used to do – there's a bunch of different techniques that people use to measure, like, how – I mean, what do you want in a pan? That's the thing, right? The answer is yes, we can do one eventually. But the question is, what do you want in a pan? What do I want in a pan? Usually I want it to not scorch. And, you know, I mean, it depends on what you're looking to do. Are you storing heat for a long time? And then you need to cast iron, right? But, you know, cast iron is good at certain things and bad at others. Most Teflon pans will die. Most nonstick – I've never had a nonstick pan that didn't die. I'm just going to put it out there. Harold, have you ever had a nonstick pan that didn't die?
I've got one that's going really well. I don't know how long it's going to last, but I'm, you know, not intentionally abusing it, but I'm not babying it either. And I've had it now for a couple of years.
What are you? Do you want to push it out there? What brand you are using?
Oh, let's see if I can pull it back. There are a couple, and I might get them confused. So, but I can, if you have that program, include me in, and I'll be waving it at my end. I'll let you know exactly, and I'll abuse it between now and then.
All right, and also, like, you guys, like, you know, people who are interested, if you want to set up a particular time to do this, like tweet on in or email in. Email is probably better for this. Email in, like, what particular horse hockery you want us to investigate beforehand, because, you know, there might be a pan that maybe, you know, I haven't used, Harold has, or, you know, one I haven't used that I can look into, you know, whether it's just one of, like, so for instance, I was at Wiley's house over the weekend, Wiley Dufresne, and he has his grandpa, for some reason, even though his grandpa wasn't a cook, although that's not true, maybe his grandpa was the one that owned a donut factory, but I think that was the other side, but the a real set of old school copper pans, like full thick old copper tinned out. And I was like, I was talking to him about it because he was going to get them restored. And back at Jean Georges, they used to have the full copper set, and back, and they probably still do. But if you walk into 59th Street and look into his kitchen, you can see in, it's like all the gleaming copper that Wiley said he used to have to polish. And I was like, is it that much better than cooking like on an all clad, which by the way, is what everyone cooks with. You know what I mean? Like 99% of people that I know, at home, and even professionally, and for some, if you have the money, they're using all clads. Basically, what do you cook with at home, Stas? Do you have all clads?
Crap, no.
Really?
Yeah.
You never stole any all clads from anyone? Anyway, what about you, Harold? Like for pots and pans and stuff like that?
Mostly all clads, but I collect lots of different things and mess with them. And,
yeah.
And as you're saying, it depends on what you're trying to do. If I really want to sear something inside, And of course, I'm going to finish it with the sears all. I'll start with a cast iron pan, and I'll put a layer of aluminum foil over it to reflect back the heat that it's otherwise going to radiate as it's heating up, and get a nice thermal mass there.
Yeah, I mean, unless something is garbage, there's always something fun you can do with it.
Yeah.
There's always some application you can have with it. Like, there are places for the old school straight black iron pans too, not cast iron or black steel pans.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. You know, there's a place for most anything, really. Like some, like for instance, like we all think that it's good to have your pans be completely even. It's not always the case. Like like in a large, like let's say you're doing like a komal, for instance, you want there to be a gradient. Or a plancha, you want there to be a gradient across it. You know what I mean? Like it's about the gradient, and so there you might not want hyper even. You might not want a big ingot of aluminum that is going to like you know or copper that's going to spread. But anyways, like so there's you know it all depends on what you're shooting for and figuring out what you can do with it. But there are some pans that are just straight garbage.
Everything I have.
Yeah.
I have the best collection of garbage in Brooklyn.
Well, you know what you guys should do is just like do what I did. Go to thrift shops. Go to thrift shops. People get rid of fantastic pans. So like what you'll do is that 9 times out of 10, they'll throw away garbage. And you'll be like, you know what? That is garbage. So you know what you don't do? You don't buy that. But like I've gotten like amazing Sabatier like 10-inch like carbon steel Sabatier knives in thrift stores. I've gotten 60-70-year-old polished cast iron Griswold pans in thrift stores for like $2. So, you know, search and you will find. You know, one person's idiocy in throwing something away can be your gain.
Yeah, me and Styles will go on a scavenger hunt one day.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. By the way, a little over a mile from here is a restaurant I got to look into. You ready for it? D'Oasis. D'Oasis. Is it? What is it? It's the D'Oasis. D'Oasis. You know, it's like D'Oasis. D'Oasis. I wonder what the hell. It's like a bar and restaurant. What the hell do you think they serve over there?
What made you look that up? What made you find that?
He was probably driving past it on his way from Stanford.
Yeah, I was driving from Stanford because I'm going to China next week to help build the centrifuge, and I would live tweet it out, except for the entire freaking country of China bans Twitter. You know?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't have a special, like, non-sedition Twitter account that allows me to, like, you know, to, you know, go on the those, they have no sense of humor. When we call the factory in China and we try to joke around with them, Stas, they can't play, right?
No.
Yeah, anyway. Anyway, point being that, yeah, I think it was in MassPeth or something. I was like, D'Oasis. Yeah. I'm going to go there after the show and maybe, you know, knock back some brewskis at D'Oasis. Anyways. Are we going to get ripped off the air? We're going to get ripped off the air.
Pretty soon.
All right. Harold, any last any super pressing Harold needs in the chat room?
Oh, let's see. They've been answering a lot of their own questions, which is great. And Tim Thraves is also offering everybody in the chat room gin and juices at Booker and Dax because he's going to be there on Monday.
Nice.
Somebody said, be careful what you offer, Tim. if Dave has time, thoughts on Brooke's superiority burger? Oh, I imagine those are good thoughts.
Well, you know, I've had his burger, but I have not yet made it to the actual restaurant. I hear only excellent things, and so the expert on this, and Harold, have you gone yet?
I haven't. It's right around the corner from where I'm staying, but it's always been mobbed when I've walked by.
So the expert on Brooks Headley and all things superiority burger at Cooking Issues is, of course, Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. Stas?
Does this person live in New York? That asked this question?
That's a good question. They did not specify.
That's good. I really hate when people write into the show and they're like, have you ever, like, sharpened a knife, Dave? Or, like, you know, and it's like, just look it up or go or do it. Like,
right.
I don't understand.
No, but the person wants
to
know.
The food is good there.
So the superiority burger
is
good.
And if you live in New York, go.
What is your favorite thing on the menu there?
The Yuba, whatever that is.
You like Yuba, huh?
I didn't think I would.
I love Yuba.
And on that note,
we're done.
We are done. So listen, I probably won't be back next week because I'll probably be in China and during transport. But when I get back from China, more Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.